And hello, it's Doug Brown joining Brendan Stone today on Unusual Sources on CFMU McMaster Radio 93.3 FM. Well, today, you know, being one of our early July broadcasts, this time of year, I'm always thinking about the events of 68 years ago in August of 1945. The only use of nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, August 6th and August 9th. So we're going to focus the first part of our show on the issue of nuclear weapons. It's sort of a forgotten issue in the mainstream media, but not here on Unusual Sources. You know, you'd think that with the passage of 68 years, we would have got rid of these awful things, but there's an incredible number of them around in 8 or 9 different states, and not much progress. In fact, sometimes I feel we're going the wrong way. Anyways, came across a great report, but with disturbing information in it. It's produced by an organization in New York called the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and they have a project, the Critical Will Project, and they have documented the modernization that is going on of the nuclear weapon systems, $1 trillion worth of modernization for nuclear weapons and delivery systems. So we have on the line the editor of the report, Ray Acheson. Ray, are you there? Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Hi, it's Doug Brown here on CFMU Radio. You were the editor of this report on the modernization of nuclear weapons that's going on by all the nuclear weapon states. Could you, first of all, tell us a bit about your organization, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom?
Sure. WILP is the oldest women's peace organization in the world. It was founded in 1915, so we're going to be celebrating our 100th anniversary fairly soon. It was founded by women from all over the world who came together in The Hague during World War I to try to put a stop to the war and destruction. And since then, we've had sections in almost 40 countries around the world, some international programs based in New York and Geneva, working on a variety of issues. I focus on disarmament and military spending, but we also have programs working on human rights and women, peace, and security issues, the environment, and economic justice.
Well, it certainly looks like you're doing great work, and a particular interest right now is the fairly recent reports that you've put out. You were the editor, I guess, of the reports on the current modernization of the nuclear weapons by every country with them. So can you tell us a bit about this report?
Sure, yes. This report looks at the nuclear weapon programs in all of the states that have nuclear weapons, with the exception of North Korea because of the lack of information. So it looks at China, France, India, Israel, Pakistan, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Those are the countries that have nuclear weapons. Currently, among all of these countries, they have approximately 17,300 nuclear weapons still. And I think a lot of people don't realize that there's so many nuclear weapons still in existence and how much money is spent on these weapons. They've spent over $100 billion, U.S. dollars, on these programs and are preparing to spend an estimated $1 trillion on these weapons over the next decade. So the report that I did looked into what the programs of these countries are, what their policies are for the coming years in terms of upgrading their weapons, extending their lives, replacing old equipment, and that sort of thing. And what we found was startling. All of these countries have programs to extend the lives of these weapons. So while they have a legal obligation under international law to disarm, they're all looking to keep their weapons for the indefinite future.
Yeah, that's really disturbing. You know, they've all signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Article 6, I think, compels them to take steps to eliminate weapons.
Exactly, it does, yes. It compels all nuclear weapon states that have signed that treaty, which is all of the countries I listed, with the exception of India, Israel, and Pakistan, who have not signed that treaty. But the rest of them have their legal obligation under that treaty to eliminate their nuclear weapons. And, of course, there are arguments that the obligations still extend to those countries as well, those other three.
Yes, and the amount of planned expenditure is just mind-boggling for me. You were saying almost $1 trillion over the coming 10 years.
That's right.
And these countries, you know, they're cutting back on social programs. Everybody's talking about austerity, and then we've got enormous global problems of poverty, and yet there's going to be $1 trillion squandered in this manner.
Exactly, yes. And that's one of the things that Wilt tries to draw attention to, is the comparison between cuts in social budgets and the spending that's going to be wasted on these weapons.
Yeah, what a lack of sense of priorities we have. You know, here in Canada, I think a lot of people sort of say, "Well, we're not a nuclear weapon state, so we sort of have clean hands." But Canada is a member of NATO and NORAD, and is very closely integrated with the U.S. Military establishment and corporate establishment. So, I think it's something we as Canadians have to work on directly on our own government, because as a NATO member, we have to take responsibility for the policies of NATO, and NATO members have a lot of, probably the majority of the weapons.
NATO itself is actually involved in a nuclear sharing arrangement, it's called, with U.S. nuclear weapons on the soil of 5 NATO countries in Europe. And those weapons are also subject to these modernization schemes. And it looks like it's going to cost about $10 billion to modernize the B-61 bombs, which are the 200 weapons that are stored in Europe under NATO arrangements. And then the extension of that is that NATO itself, in its security doctrine, still says that it relies on nuclear weapons to protect the security of all of its members. So Canada is directly involved in that sense, because it is still relying on nuclear weapons as an element of its security posture.
Yes, for sure. You know, we have to take responsibility as Canadians because of these links, and also we, just as world citizens, I think it's important that all of us do something to try to counteract this direction that we've been going in, you know, the corporate media isn't covering the issue hardly at all. You'd think that there was no problem out there. Instead of, we've been on a hair trigger for almost 7 decades, just one miscalculation could trigger a global catastrophe.
Absolutely. And the extent that you get mainstream media coverage of this issue, they might mention that the U.S. and Russia have engaged in some bilateral reductions in recent years. They negotiated a follow-on to the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty in 2010. But what the mainstream media fails to mention is that in the United States and in Russia, ratification of those treaties domestically was contingent upon promises from the governments to spend billions on nuclear weapons. So in the United States, for example, the Obama administration had to commit to spend $185 billion over the next 20 years on upgrading nuclear weapons, just to get senators, Republican senators, to consent to ratify the treaty.
It seems so counterproductive. In fact, it sort of reminds me of, some 30 years ago, Ronald Reagan's build down philosophy, which really was just an end run around genuine disarmament.
Right, exactly.
Okay. In terms of what citizens can do. Do you have some suggestions, you know, for our listeners, you know, who want to take steps to, you know, persuade our government and other governments to move in a different direction?
Absolutely. Right now, Wilkes is very involved in the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons, ICAN, and it's fortunate this interview is happening this week because this is Nuclear Abolition Week, which ICAN organizes annually to raise awareness around the world to the issues of nuclear disarmament. And so one way that Canadians can get involved is by joining ICAN as individuals or through their organizations and participating in our campaigns and actions, which happen everywhere. There are several organizations in Canada that are already very active in the campaign that we work with internationally, so that's been great. Part of the campaign's objective is to achieve a treaty that will ban nuclear weapons forever. Of course, we talked about the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but as we noted, that hasn't been complied with in terms of its disarmament provisions. And the treaty is structured in a way that it created this two-tiered category when it was negotiated so that countries without nuclear weapons were not to possess them, and countries with nuclear weapons were supposed to get rid of them. But we're asking for a treaty that bans nuclear weapons for everybody at the same time, the same way that we have prohibitions on biological and chemical weapons and on landmines and cluster munitions and other deadly weapon systems that have catastrophic humanitarian consequences. So that's an excellent thing that civilians in Canada can get involved in.
Yes, and thanks for mentioning that, Ray, because I do have some information on the ICAN campaign, and as you had mentioned, a number of disarmament groups in Canada are involved in this, and we have an upcoming event on Friday, August 9th in Hamilton at City Hall. There's going to be a vigil at the Peace Pole, and that's located at the corner of Bay and Hunter. Actually, within Hamilton, peace groups have been having annual observances of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August. So this is just following that that tradition. But a variety of groups are involved in this, and that's at 12 noon on August 9th. And I'll be repeating that announcement as the summer goes along. So I encourage people to attend that. But also, there are, as you say, there's a lot of groups involved in disarmament and in the ICAN campaign in particular, which is an international campaign. So it's the way it has to be done. And one initiative that I've got information on is working on our parliamentarians. It's a parliamentary appeal for a nuclear weapons ban. And so that's, again, encourage people to contact their local peace and disarmament groups in Hamilton. There's the Hamilton Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. And there's a number of other groups, including Ceasefire, involved. And you can get this information easily on their websites. So, Ray, thank you very much for joining us today. And again, congratulations on this report. I encourage people to have a look at it because, you know, many reports that get out there are voluminous and really take hours to digest. I found this one quite digestible. It was so concise and systematic in its presentation. So I congratulate you and your co-authors on putting so much information together. It's well documented, and it's as I said, quite digestible. You know you can download it from your website and read it probably within half an hour and absorb a tremendous amount of information. So thanks again, Ray, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And that was Ray Atchison. She was with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in New York City.
Well, thanks, Doug. I think that was a highly appropriate interview, probably the best one we could have done today, because the next segment after at 5:30 or thereabouts is about Syria. And the thing is, of course, if you look at globalresearch.ca, you know, Global Research, the website there, one of the recent articles on there, I can't quite remember the exact title, but it's something like, why is the United States still preparing for nuclear war? And it's a good question. I haven't even read the article yet, but I learned quite a lot just from the very posing of the question. Since the Cold War ended in 1992, a lot of people have thought that we're safe, that there's not going to be a World War III, there's not going to be a nuclear war. But the United States continues to engage in all sorts of conflicts on the other side of the world, and it ruffles a lot of feathers. What it's doing in Syria right now, funding one side in a civil war, it's increasingly difficult to hide. It's aggravating a lot of people. It's Russia, China. If they don't pull back on this, it could escalate in a very dangerous fashion. At 5:30, we're playing an interview with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, where he says that it's time to demonstrate against the potential of escalation in Syria. And he's going to be explaining why that is. But overall, I mean, if you have a doomsday clock, I mean, the hand is still pretty close to midnight.
Yes, it's been precarious. And, you know, most of us thought, I mean, even if you accepted the Cold War dogma, the Soviet Union disbanded how many years ago? You know, 24 years ago? And the Warsaw Pact disbanded at the same time. So the entire rationale for having military alliances like NATO disappeared at that time, and yet they're bigger than, and stronger than ever.
Well, this is a really important point, Doug. I was listening to one of our previous programs. It was a recording of Michael Parenti's lecture given 2 years ago. Dr. Parenti is a well-known U.S. academic. He's been called the greatest political scientist in America, in the United States. He's been touring in Canada a few times, and he was in Hamilton in 2011, and he gave a talk called Imperialism and the 99%. And it was to do with the Occupy movement and how the domestic policy in the United States relates to their foreign wars abroad. In other words, how this security state that we know so much about now, this clampdown on the civil rights of all citizens, relates to this policy of infinite, endless war abroad. And Parenti said, with the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 92 and Warsaw Pact just prior to that, you have this perfect experiment now where you can see, you have these factors in the way the U.S. behaves, and you remove one of those factors. You remove the Soviet Union. And we've done that now. We've removed the Soviet Union, but the United States still continues to behave in the same way, that it has a massive military budget. It's in wars and conflicts all over the place. It's got assassinations and overthrowing governments, coup d'etats. So its aggressive foreign policy, which it claimed was defensive, never really changed. And when the massive opposition is removed, the United States still continues to build more nuclear weapons, modernize the nuclear arsenal, send more troops overseas, and so forth.
And I remember reading on the, actually on, they have a website, Project for a New American Century. And this was during the, you know, early Bush period. And it really laid out a groundwork, you know, for American domination of everything, everywhere. I'm just so disappointed at this aggressive international stand that is being taken.
Well, it's been discussed to death, all of these grand proclamations that were made by U.S. leaders from Reagan to Bush to Clinton and so on about how they were going to administer the world. You know, there's all this talk about this new world order, but it seems to be a new world disorder, because the policy is to create instability, to break up countries, right? Iraq doesn't really function properly as a country anymore. Afghanistan, they'll be lucky to have any kind of functional government in 5 or 10 years. They're trying to break up Syria. They broke up Sudan. It doesn't end. They would love to have a bunch of weak dependencies all over the world rather than people who can challenge them. Even allies of the United States don't really have a whole lot of independence or sovereignty. Just the other day, President Obama referred to President Hollande in France, by which he meant President Hollande. You know, Obama doesn't need to learn how to pronounce the name of a major NATO ally and nuclear power like France. We just learned that the U.S. is spying on France, Germany, and a whole bunch of other partners and allies. The politicians made a bit of noise in those countries, but they're not going to do anything.
No, and the politicians also are going against their own public opinion. You know, like we're talking about Syria, American public opinion is firmly set against military action.
That's right. It's 80 to 85% are opposed to military intervention. Something like only 10 to 15% support the idea.
But yet in Congress and in the presidency, you'd think that it was 85% in favor.
I don't think we're saying anything new by stating that what happens in Congress doesn't really reflect the interest or the will of the American populace anymore. It's been clear for a long time now. You know, you can get lots of information on this. There's radio programs such as ours, but on the internet, there's a lot of alternative news sources, and I've listed a few, or I've seen a few, and put lists together. The classic ones, I guess you could use, are Counterpunch, for example. That's one of your first lines of defense against the mainstream media. I'd recommend Counterpunch for its incisive political commentary, well-written articles. Then you have Global Research, which is a Canadian site that is looking at how that whole thing is unfolding with the U.S. plan to dominate. You know, what do they say they're going to do? What are they actually doing? How's it all unfolding? Very exciting website. Antiwar.com, they're pretty consistent in their anti-interventionist position, and they have a spotlight of a lot of interesting articles. So you can look those up, as well as Dissident Voice and Common Dreams, The Angry Arab. There's lots of sources. You can find us online, too. Maybe I'll mention that at the end of the program. But we got to do some promos. We're going to run some promos. We got some musical interlude. When we come back, I'm going to bring you that interview with Ramsey Clark.